here. Manuela is here. Enrique, right? Mm-hmm. I'll get it.
Probably by like May, but.
The thing that happens is when I finally get everyone's name to their face, the semester ends. And then I got a whole new group. I got to do it all over. I've been teaching for nearly 30 years. I've had thousands of students.
All right, well, I was going to do a little Q&A, but we'll give some people who take public transportation and get stuck in traffic a chance to get here.
Federalism, the system of government in which we live, constantly evolving because of politics, because of historical events. As I said when I was talking about government, you know, a nation's political system of any given moment in time is always in flux, and it's impacted by religion and history and politics and so many things. We started off as the Venn diagram. Two spheres of government. Federal government that had specific powers. State government that had specific powers. But where do they overlap? And what happens if they conflict? Well, as we mentioned, right out of the gates, the Founding Fathers were divided. Some people said the nation should be more powerful. Some people said the states. Issues rose. Political crises got into the Supreme Court. Supreme Court ruled in using the powers of judicial review. Slowly switching the Venn diagram on its side, putting the national government above the states. But the states' writers didn't stop. They had legal theories. Nullification, interposition, secession. And secession was constantly talked about throughout the early part of our nation's history. Jefferson, Madison, and many others, our founding generation, said, if push comes to shove, the states have a right to leave, just like a divorce. I mean, imagine if we didn't allow divorce, and you married somebody and you were stuck with them and they were abusive and violent. And we came close to secession during the War of 1812, during the 1830s. We were on the brink, but compromise was always able to be achieved. Fortunately, 1860, compromise could not. And 11 states would secede from the Union. Now, as I said last class,
and when you think about it, and you actually read, you read Lincoln's words
when he became president, you know, the myth is very different. Because the myth that you learned about Lincoln was Lincoln at the end of the war. But before the Civil War started, yeah, he was in an abolitionist party, or that's what the Republicans were formed on, ending slavery. But he didn't want to push that far, because Lincoln understood the slave states, and it wasn't just the southern states that seceded. There were four slave states that stayed in the Union. He understood that their economies were based on slavery. Slavery which the United States did not invent. Slavery was a system of economics that had been in place in every single civilization that has ever existed throughout human history. Plus, our Constitution prevented the United States government from getting involved. Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, basically says that if the federal government is going to take your property, it has to provide due process of law, and it has to be for a government purpose, and you have to get paid compensation. Lincoln knew the national government couldn't just take everyone's slaves. It would be violation of the Constitution. So he hoped to achieve a compromise. Some type of solution. But the Southerners reacted first. South Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, Texas, Florida, one by one, seceding after seceding. And then Fort Sumter happened. When the Army of the Confederacy opened fire on that Union fort in Charleston Harbor, igniting a flame that would last for 4 years, culminating in the deaths of one out of every 100 man alive in the United States in 1861. One of the highest percentages of death in any war that we ever fought. Lincoln, bring it back, was opposed to secession. Lincoln did not believe that secession for states was legitimate. He believed that once the Union was formed, it was permanent.
So that's one of the reasons why he was willing to commit. And, interestingly enough, while the radical Republicans, members of his own party, called the Southerners traitors, he never used that type of language. You know, he considered this just to be a very violent disagreement. Which is why, as the war came to an end, he proposed a peace plan that essentially would have pardoned everybody except for the top leaders of the Confederacy. All of the soldiers, all of the Southerners that were forced to, he would have pardoned them all. And he would have worked with them try to figure out a solution. But of course, John Wilkes Booth, prevented that. He created a whole new round of politics.
That would result in significant change.
With Lincoln dead, the radical Republicans, that's what they were called, I'm not calling them, that's what they were referred to, because they were the extreme wing of the abolitionist party, decided that they were going to attempt to crush states' rights completely. They were going to use the power of the federal government to keep the states in line, obedient to the will of the national government.
They did many things, particularly during Reconstruction.
If you've ever taken U.S. history, when you can study the immediate post-war period, essentially what the Union government did, the national government did, was implement martial law and a complete military occupation of the Confederate States. They denied the Southerners of life, liberty, and property, and impose their will upon the South.
The best example of what they did is how they would eliminate the ability of the South to rise again. By attacking the key areas that the Southerners used nullification, interposition, and secession to protect. These areas can be seen in what is referred to as the Reconstruction Amendments. Does anyone know which amendments to the U.S. Constitution were passed during Reconstruction?
There were three of them.
The 13th Amendment. The 14th Amendment
and the 15th Amendment.
13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, 15th
Amendment. Does anyone know what the 13th Amendment did? What about slavery? Free or free? Free or not free?
Like free, I think. That's when they codified it.
They did more than that. The 13th Amendment forever abolished any type of servitude. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery forever, but also indentured servitude. Did you learn about indentured servants at any point? That's how most of the Europeans came over. They would basically sell themselves to people over here for a period of time. Well, that was still allowed too, but that went out the window as well with the 13th Amendment. Interestingly enough, the 13th Amendment was imposed upon the states, because previously the states determined what was property and what was not. Well, now that's gone. Now that's gone. The federal government now, with this precedent, the 13th Amendment, could begin telling you what you could own and what you could not own. Pay attention to the news. There's going to be lots and lots and lots of conversations about the 14th Amendment in the next coming months, because the Supreme Court of the United States is potentially going to make a significant ruling that could impact the way that the 14th Amendment is viewed in our country.
Citizenship.
What?
Like the due process.
Yeah, due process of citizenship, equal protection, and due process. So, to put it back in context of what was going on in the 1860s during Reconstruction, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. Now, all these slaves are free, but all citizenship requirements were previously controlled by the states. So the 14th Amendment essentially superseded all of the state laws. And for the first time, the concept of a United States citizen was created. Because as I said previously, you used to be a citizen of your state. Now you're a citizen of the United States. But it went further, because it didn't just apply to citizens. It gave every person life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, due process of law, equal protection under the law. This was important because previously, slaves were not people. Slaves were considered to be property. So all of the laws you fell under, if you were a slave, were property laws. But now, if you were a person, no local government, no state could deprive you of equal protection of law. They had to treat you just like everybody else. Now, by the way, what's going to be the controversy at the Supreme Court? Well, there's a clause in there that basically says that all persons born in the United States are citizens of the United States. And back in the 1960s, the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted that to create what is referred to as birthright citizenship. So if your parents simply walked into our country and you were born here, the courts were interpreting that to mean you essentially were a citizen. But here's the problem. that precedent ignores the full clause that's contained in the 14th Amendment.
Because it says, basically, all persons born here become citizens unless they're subject to the laws of another country. So since the 1960s, any child born here would be given U.S. citizenship. But that's not what the amendment says. The amendment basically says if your parents are citizens of another country, you don't become a United States citizen. Because your parents are citizens of another country. So the only way you could become a citizen is if your parents come here and begin the legal process to become citizens.
So I don't know how the Supreme Court's going to rule down, because again, think of how many children, babies, have been born in this country since the 1960s. If the Supreme Court rules literally, conservatively, then all of those citizens, their citizenship is going to be in question. Which could create a whole, I mean, for me, being I love politics and debates, it's going to be delicious. The arguments and the politics.
Or they could basically say, you know, this is going to create way too many headaches, so we're just going to maintain precedent. You know, the way it's been.
But I don't know. I don't know. So next semester when I talk about this, you know, I might have to change, you know, how I do things. But pay attention, because federalism always, always is in flux. All right, so that's the 14th Amendment.
It creates citizenship for those who are born here and equal protection and due process for all persons. Can't the states nor the local governments can deny.
15th Amendment. Well,
we freed them. We gave them equal protection. But what's the most important right that you can have as being a citizen? The right to vote. So the 15th Amendment prohibited states or local government from denying access to the polls. But, and I'm not trying to be insulting. The 15th Amendment said no man can be denied the right to the vote on the basis of race, ethnicity, and previous conditions of servitude. Why did the 15th Amendment only give the right to vote to men? What about the ladies? Yeah, the ladies couldn't vote in the 1860s. Come on now. You have to wait until 1919.
All right. Last bit on the Reconstruction Amendments.
And obviously, I want you to remember, 13th Amendment, no more slaves. 14th Amendment, equal protection, due process for everybody. 15th Amendment, right to vote. Can't be denied on the basis of race, color, religion, blah, blah, blah. But the most important aspect of all of those three amendments was the last clause in all three. It gave Congress the power to regulate those activities. Meaning, Congress created for itself jurisdiction. So if there's ever a dispute that could potentially result in someone being a slave, it's going to the federal courts, not the states. Or if you're denied equal protection, you go into the federal courts, not the states. Why? Why do you want to have the federal government oversee those basic fundamental elements of being a citizen in the United States? What were the states doing previously? they were defining what people's rights were, which meant every single state could have different standards. And do you want to have go back to where every single state had different standards? No. So we're going to make it universal.
You've got to make it universal. And to bring it back, they created United States citizenship.
Questions? We got them all, right? We understand Lincoln's position. We know secession, interposition, nullification. We understand the radical Republicans and the amendments that they passed. The goal was to crush the states.
And the end result was what James Marshall and Alexander Hamilton and all the other ones dreamed of. Nation-centered. That became the supreme law of the land.
No more Venn diagram. No more Venn diagram. Now DC is on top.
And that would give rise to the third form of federalism in United States government history. The first were the Articles of Confederacy, where the states were in charge. The second was the system as in created under the Constitution, the dual Venn diagram. But post-Civil War, you created a form of federalism which many political scientists refer to as either dual federalism, although some others call it the layer cake. Because after all, who in their right mind is against a nice piece of delicious layer cake? You get the stacks, you get the delicious frosting or whatever, or black forest cake. Not only do you get the frosting in there, but you got the cherries and all the rest smothered in other frosting on top or fondant. But the key is each layer in a cake is cut to fit perfectly below the layer above it. So now you would have the federal government become the outer shell. The fondant, the frosting, the part that looks like the cake. But below the frosting, you still have the state government, and the state governments are above the county governments are above the local governments. But the key is, like the pink outline, the federal government now controls all the edges, all the bounds.
And by the way,
this is, if you have a chance to study constitutional history post-Civil War, you see this mindset in all of the significant Supreme Court decisions post-Civil War. If there ever was a dispute between which level of government was on top, it would always come out the same, U.S. government. If you have a city getting a little out of line, you know, maybe not complying with the state, Supreme Court will come in and say, no, city, get back in line, you're going to obey the state, because the state's going to obey the U.S. government. It was always this top-down controlled system.
But the problem was, again, if you study U.S. history during this period, America was changing.
From Reconstruction until the beginning of the 20th century, the United States changed at a more rapid pace than any other country on Earth throughout the entirety of their history. We went from being a country that had regional zones of our economies, fledgling industrial base, you had the production of cash crops for exportation down in the south, and then you had, you know, the Midwest producing the food that everyone eat, to this massive growth where America raced across the continent, adding new states, adding new towns and cities. You had the discovery of gold, you had the creation of the transcontinental railroads. You had massive industrial expansion because many of the factories of the North moved down to the South to get cheap labor. You know, America was transformed. You had tiny little towns suddenly growing and becoming cities. America was moving so fast that politics, the politics of that era, was just trying to figure out, okay, how far could a town go? How far could a county go? How far could a state go? How far would the federal government let them? So, rather than me trying to cover everything that happened, because I can't, I'm just going to give you a few examples.
Start off with railroads. This is a good example to look at. Railroads. Railroads were businesses. Businesses that were owned by companies.
So this means they were private enterprises. They existed to make profit.
But if you think about it, what is a railroad?
You know, what actually is a railroad? You know, sure, you have the corporation. Which has a headquarters somewhere in some city. But the corporation isn't the railroad. The railroad
are the boxcars full of tons and tons of things.
Railroads are the men who worked the railroads. And the railroads were the biggest mover of commodities from point A to point B. A railroad isn't just in a town. A railroad just isn't in a county. Heck, railroads aren't just in a state. Railroads would grow like a network of spider webs, spreading across the entire continent. So who's in charge? Who should be regulating these enterprises? Because what happens if a company, corporation, gives special breaks to one customer, but screws over another customer? What happens if the railroads don't give their workers health insurance? Because, by the way, you want to talk about an industry that you had a good chance of dying in? Work on a railroad line. And then what happens if the worker is dead? What about his widow? What about his kids? Should there be any type of benefits for them? How many hours should they work? Should we have standard size rails? Should we have inspections of safety? Again, if you're ever interested, I mean, I'm not really like big into like, you know, ooh, the choo-choo train aspect of it. But if you ever want to do a fascinating analysis into a component of our economy, look at what was going on with these railroad companies in the 19th century. You had guys making the equivalent of billions of dollars, but you also had railroad lines that had catastrophic accidents, where they would whip up a bridge real quick, and just as the train was going off, the bridge would collapse, killing everybody on board. I mean, it was just insane.
So who should be in charge of maintaining standards, safety, inspections, and all those parts with regulation?
Well, there is nothing expressly in the U.S. Constitution that gives the federal government the power to regulate businesses. There's no clause that says federal government can regulate. Doesn't say it. So, prior to the Civil War, all businesses were regulated primarily by the states.
And by the way, one of the first significant rulings on the railroad industry occurred in 1877 in the case Munn v. Illinois. Here's your backstory. It'll be brief. 1871, the state of Illinois passed a law that established a maximum rate that could be charged for storing agricultural products. So Illinois put a price cap on how much railroads could charge.
Well, the partnership of Ira Y. Munn and George L. Scott, who owned a warehouse firm,
didn't follow state law. And they started overcharging customers. So Illinois found out about it, gave them a fine for violating the law, which of course the partners challenged in state court.
Ultimately, the Illinois courts found them guilty of violating state law.
Well, Munn then decided to appeal to the United States Federal Court because of the newly enacted 14th Amendment.
The 14th Amendment requires due process.
Because they claimed that a price cap was stealing their property, that their money, their profits were their property, and that the state didn't have a right to deprive them of making profit. So the Supreme Court took the case. They heard it,
and initially, they looked at precedent. And the Chief Justice at the time, Morris Wade, decided on whether or not a private company could be regulated for the public interest.
You know, what's for the good of the public?
Well, he used precedent, went all the way back to cases that occurred in the 1600s in England. And precedent said
central government had a power to regulate businesses if the public interest was at stake. So what's the public interest? You can't overcharge small businesses, small farmers. Because people have a public interest in trying to get cheap food or reasonably priced food.
So in this case, the Supreme Court said, yes, the state of Illinois could regulate.
Interesting dynamic. Just what I said. Previously, it was all done by state regulations. And then the Supreme Court initially said, yes, the states can continue to regulate.
But more issues rose up.
More legal disputes, more challenges. Because the moment you told one state they could regulate, all the states jumped in one attempt to regulate. Which would give rise to a second case about a decade later. Wabash, St. Louis, and Pacific Railroad v. Illinois, where Munn was about regulating warehouse prices. Wabash was about regulating railroad rates. Chicago, by the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, was becoming a major railroad hub. There were more railroad lines going into Chicago than any other city other than New York. And companies would charge rates based upon which line they came in. Well, Wabash charged a set rate for goods coming on their train from the southernmost tip of Illinois. But they charged a higher rate from goods coming just across the border in Gary, Indiana. This was 8 times as long as this route. Well, plus, the line that goes out of state goes out of state. So, should Illinois be allowed to regulate these rates? Should Indiana be able to regulate these rates? We have a major issue. So where do we find the solution?
Well, the Supreme Court stepped in.
They completely reversed the decision they made in Munn, which allowed the states to regulate. And instead ruled, this is an example of interstate commerce.
And did we not see in Gibbons v. Ogden
that Chief Justice John Marshall ruled that in all areas of interstate commerce, it's the job of the federal government to regulate? Marshall, after all, defined commerce to be the who, the what, the where. Any good, how it's carried, what it is, and where it goes. If it begins in one state, ends in the other, no matter how far, the federal government has a right to regulate. It's the job of the Congress. So in one decade, the Supreme Court went from enforcing the previous mindset, no, the state should be regulating these things, to saying, no. This is so important to interstate commerce, the Congress should regulate. But wait, where in the Constitution does it say expressly that Congress has the authority to regulate business? Well, it does not. So how are we going to get to the point where Congress can regulate?
Well,
go back to McCulloch v. Maryland, where the U.S. Supreme Court said that Congress has implied powers, thanks to the Necessary and Proper Clause. If Congress has the right to regulate interstate commerce, it should be able to do whatever is necessary and proper to regulate interstate commerce.
Landmark decision that opened the way for Congress to step in. And that's what they did.
Once that decision came down from Congress, the very next year, Congress jumped in and passed a law called the Interstate Commerce Act.
This law would give the federal government the power to oversee and regulate railroad activity. Because you know something? Railroad lines just don't start and stop within a state.
Because the particular line in question from Wabash actually went south into Kansas and Nebraska, went all the way down to Texas. So you can't just say, oh, the line starts here. No, you gotta follow it all the way out. And suddenly it's an interstate line.
Oops, sorry, I gotta go back.
It also created what was called the Interstate Commerce Commission. The ICC, the Interstate Commerce Commission. Which is a federal agency that can go around and travel across the country, show up at any business that's involved in interstate commerce. They can inspect and they can fine. Today, this law allows the federal government to regulate anything dealing with planes, trains, boats, automobiles, anything that travels in interstate commerce. Questions? All right, the federal government made railroads easy. It was once the states, they took it away. They made it solely in the powers of the federal government to regulate. But, like the aforementioned, very delicious black forest cake, once it sits in the refrigerator for a little bit, the delicious middle frosting and cherries bleeds into the chocolate cake. Just like certain powers of government. So if powers bleed, how can you tell where to begin and end?
What are we talking about? Well, here's one. Law enforcement.
Congress can pass laws. A state can pass laws. Who's in charge of enforcing state laws? Well, obviously the states. Well, who's in charge of enforcing federal law? You'd think it would be the federal government. But what happens if enforcement of federal law connects, possibly interferes, with a state law?
Ooh. Well, you create an agency that has the authority to do just that. And what do we call the law enforcement agency of the federal government? What's the primary one? Well, FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation.
This agency was created by a law of Congress in 1908.
What prompted it?
Well, the assassination of President William McKinley. He was shot. He went to World's Fair in Buffalo. Shot, died a few weeks later. Well, technically what happened was a homicide, a murder, and traditionally murder was one of the crimes that states investigate. But We're talking the President of the United States. Shouldn't there be some type of agency created to, well, investigate any harm to our national leaders, our national government? Plus, during the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt, you had a bunch of radical Marxist anarchists that were causing shenanigans across the country. In fact, one of the most significant acts of terrorism on United States soil took place, I think, in 1904 or 1905, when one of these anarchists took a wagon full of explosives and put it right up in front of the New York Stock Exchange building, detonated it. Didn't blow the building up, but caused significant damage and killed a few dozen people. 1907 or 1908, there was an act of terrorism up in Maine. A newly built school was blown up, killing all the children inside, because one of the guys in town didn't want to pay the taxes for the school. There were bombs being sent through the mail. United States Senator, one of his house, I don't want to say servants, but one of his house staffs, opened a parcel at his house in California, blew up, killed him. Crazy things were going on. So President Teddy Roosevelt committed to create this agency to go out and investigate. The task was investigate federal crimes. Interestingly enough, do you want to know the first special task force that was created for the FBI in 1909? Prostitution wings.
It began going across the country investigating prostitution because the federal government passed a law banning prostitution. Well, here's the thing. If an FBI shows up at a crime scene in Massachusetts, and if it is in any way remotely a federal crime, the FBI agent has jurisdiction. Before I go into banking, I got a true story for you. I got a buddy that's a state police officer. And as we know, Massachusetts decriminalized marijuana. But marijuana is still a controlled substance under federal law. So he pulls this kid over. And the kid did something stupid. He did not comply. Had he simply complied with the officer, my buddy probably would have given him a warning. But no, this guy thought he was tough. He whipped out his phone and he started dropping F-bombs and fuck the police and all this stuff. So my buddy was like, all right. He smelled the pot, and he just said, why don't you hold on here for a second? Takes his license and registration, goes back in his cruiser, calls another state in. Another state he comes in, positions himself in front of his kid's car. So now he's got a state trooper in the front, state trooper in the back. And then the next call was to one of his buddies in the FBI. 15 minutes later, FBI arrives. They arrest the kid for being in possession of marijuana, which was a federal crime. Even though the amount he had, he would have been fined under state law. That little local incident became a federal incident. Kid was convicted and went to jail.
That's the way the FBI works. If the FBI shows up, if the FBI determines that it's a federal crime, the FBI will have jurisdictional authority. So word of advice, be polite, no matter what. Because even if the cop does wrong, that's when after you're done, you go and get a lawyer and you sue. But if you think you are going to win an argument with a cop, you will lose every time.
All right, banking.
banking. Banking was traditionally a local business. We talked about that in McCulloch v. Maryland. It was the states who gave charters to banks. Like, it's this job of the states to give charters to businesses.
And it's up to the states to regulate banks.
And, as we covered, the Constitution does not expressly give power to the Congress to get involved in banking.
As we said,
they can mint money, they can collect taxes, but there's nothing that says they have any authority over banking.
But the problem is if you look for
throughout the history of the country, we talked about the first bank, which wasn't an issue, then we talked about the second bank. So we did have U.S. banks, but eventually those would be suspended and we wouldn't get that again. We had national currency, but we had local banks. And each state was allowed to put whatever regulations it wanted on the local banks. We also had economic highs and we had recessions. And we had depressions. We had runs on the bank. A lot of bad economic history in our country. People literally went from having lots of money to none.
So fast forward into the 20th century. And you had a president
that was elected in part because of a recession that happened during the presidency of his predecessor.
1912, Woodrow Wilson becomes president.
The Democrats also took control of Congress for the first time since the Civil War. Because during the presidency of Taft, America suffered a huge recession. And to make matters worse, the United States government got a bailout from the wealthiest banker on earth, J.P. Morgan. He actually gave to the federal government tons and tons and tons of gold. That was scandal. How could a banker have more money than the United States government? How could a banker have more power over our economy than the federal government? So the political reaction was Congress would step in. 1913,
they would pass a law called the Federal Reserve Act.
Under this law, which is still in operation today, this system is still in operation, the United States would be divided up into 12 different geographic zones. And in each zone, there would be one reserve bank.
All of the banks inside of that zone would be required by law to subscribe.
So the local bank, the state bank, would have to give 6% of their capital reserves to subscribe to this system. In exchange, the Federal Reserve Bank would take all of the money that they had in their vault and convert it. These. See, look what it says right on top. It says Federal Reserve Note. This quasi-public government agency that was created would be responsible for creating a standard U.S. currency. So let's say the bank had $1 million in its reserve. It would take that $1 million in gold or silver or what it was, give it to the federal government in exchange for $1 million in these. And so when you went to go make a withdrawal or cash a paycheck, instead of giving you whatever your check was in gold or silver, the bank would now give you these. And you would take these to stores. And you would use these to shop.
The goal was to stabilize the economy because now everybody would you be using the same form of currency. And the Federal Reserve could regulate the value of money by controlling the amount that's in circulation. If prices were too low, the Federal Reserve has the ability to trigger inflation by shrinking the amount of dollars in circulation. Or they could cause deflation by flooding the market and devaluing the value of the money. This would give the federal government the ultimate power over every man and woman in this country. Because what is your money worth? What is your money worth? Oh, it's whatever the Federal Reserve says it is. The Federal Reserve would be controlled and still is by a Federal Reserve Board. There are 7 members, one of which is the chair, and the Secretary of Treasury.
They're the ones that control the value of money. They're also the ones that control the interest rates. So here's the amazing thing. If anything ever happened to Washington, D.C., all of this, yeah, look, looks like I got some good green here. I got a good green, not as big as my usual roll, but I could do some damage if I went to Canes or Checkers down the road or something like that, or Dunks. But those individual notes are only worth what the federal government says they're worth. And why is that important? Well, if you work your butt off and you save money and you get to the point where you retire, and then you live for 30 years, the dollar that you saved when you first started working is now worth a fraction of what it will be when you retire. Joe Biden became president in 2021. Any dollar that you had in the bank in 2021 is now worth 35% less in 2026. Because of the policies of the Fed under President Joe Biden. President Trump's trying to correct that. But will he ever be able to get the dollar back to the value it was in 2021? Probably not. So the more the federal government spends, the more your money becomes worth less. Period coinciding with the presidencies of Teddy Roosevelt, Taft, and Woodrow Wilson is commonly referred to as the Progressive Era. Just as the federal government began experimenting with interfering in traditional powers of the state, the federal government also began experimenting, moving into other areas, new fields of the economy, of the technology that had never been there, and started making significant inroads that again would essentially allow the federal government to centralize full authority over just about every single aspect of our life. For instance, they created the Federal Communications Commission. Do you want to know the reason why you can't see boobs on TV at 6 p.m.? because the FCC controls whatever goes out on the airwaves. And by the way, speaking of the FCC, I don't know if you were listening, the halftime show, Bad Bunny, he might have gotten himself into a little bit of trouble. Because apparently in his broken Spanish, he possibly could have been saying very explicit things. And the FCC is investigating it. Because you're not allowed to depict sexual acts, explicit content, prior to 10 p.m. Why? The FCC says so. FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. Anything that you consume has been investigated, researched, reviewed by the FDA. The job of the FDA is to make sure when you drink your milk or your meat or whatever, it actually is meat or milk or whatever. Prior to the creation of the FDA, ground beef, for example, would beef cows would be slaughtered in these massive, unclean, gross, disgusting slaughterhouses in Chicago. It would be all ground up, the entire cow, including the bones, including hair. And if any workers' fingers got ripped off, that would be in there. Rats, rat poop, pee, the pigeons that would fly in, all of that stuff would get into your food. And if a chunk of meat fell off the conveyor belt, they typically had sawdust down on the ground to keep it from being slippery. The worker would just pick it up, put it back in the belt. I'm sure you all heard the old wives' tale about what goes into a hot dog. Well, stories about what people were eating were getting into the news, and people were freaking out. Politics! So the federal government stepped in and created the FDA to regulate all food and drugs. There was also concern about the expansion of industrialism, the way the factories were consuming our resources. So it actually began several presidents prior, but during the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt, he cordoned off more acreage of U.S. lands to be part of the National Park Service than any other president before or since. And the federal government began going after the big businesses who became too big. Trust busting. All of this stuff, unprecedented. The United States government never did anything like this prior. But this is what the people demanded. So the Congress and the presidents responded. And it would overnight change the nature of the United States. But how are you going to get the states to go along with this? Because if a land, a parcel of land is within the borders of a state, that's state land. It's not U.S. government land, it's state land. How are you going to get the states to agree to this? How are you going to allow the states to agree to federal inspectors to come in? How are you going to get the states to agree to banking regulation, law enforcement? Well, you buy them off. You give them money. In order to keep the states from resisting, the federal government began sending federal dollars down to the states in the form of grants. Free cash.
Free cash. Why? Well, there were other things going on.
You wanted better agricultural oversight. You wanted the construction of highways and roads. All those things take money. Telephone poles for first the telegraph, then the telephone. How are you going to have all this happen?
Give them money. But where's the money going to come from?
Well, the progressives came up with an interesting idea. Instead of relying on tariffs, which was the primary income stream of the United States government, along with excise taxes on things like alcohol and stuff like that, the progressives decided, oh, let's go and tax people's income. You do realize before you get your paycheck, the federal government and the state gets its taste first. Your company is not allowed to give you a paycheck until they pay the amount that's owed to the government. Why? Because the Constitution was amended. Prior to the 16th Amendment, the federal government was not allowed to impose a direct tax. They couldn't come after individuals directly. But the 16th Amendment allowed them to tax income. And think about it. If you make, I don't know what the tax brackets are, because I know with the big, beautiful bill, I know all of the tax rates will change to our benefit. But I think if you make like less than $40,000, I think your tax rate's like 10%. Might be 15%, I'm not sure what the exact rate is. So if you make only a little bit of money, you do have to contribute. Say it's 10%. So you make $40,000, you have to give to the federal government $4,000 out of that $40,000. Massachusetts has an income tax of 5%. So that means you also have to give Massachusetts $5,000. No, $2,000. So your $40,000 suddenly becomes $36,000, less than that. $26,000? Maybe not that high. But because the federal government needed money, so it amended the Constitution to allow the federal government to take that money. And a lot of that money goes into grants that comes back to the states. And of course, here's the interesting thing. Just because now the federal government's becoming bigger and more power and more intrusive, think of the layer cake. The bigger the layer cake gets, that means the states are also going to be able to grow. The towns are also going to be able to grow. So during this period, the national government didn't supplant, didn't erase the states. No, they encouraged the states to grow in other areas. Schools. Schools were traditionally a local issue. It was the town that built the schoolhouse. It was the town that hired the teacher. It was the town who determined the curriculum. It was the town that controlled the calendar. Well, during this period, the states began taking over. States began setting standards. How long do the kids have to go to school? What do they have to learn? What are the requirements of becoming a teacher? Took it away from the local government, the states took it over.
It started creating public colleges, Quinsig.
It started allowing welfare programs. It started expanding fire departments, police departments.
All more contact points between the government and the people.
The states also began passing health and safety regulations and consumer protection laws.
And generally, the Supreme Court was good with it all,
in most areas. But there were some where the Supreme Court said, eh, maybe we're going a little too far.
For instance,
during the Woodrow Wilson presidency, Congress passed, and President Woodrow Wilson signed into a law
that attempted to ban child labor. Because the kiddos used to have to go to work to help mom and dad pay the bills, instead of going and spending, what,
13 years sitting in a classroom?
coloring in between the lines, playing with some blocks.
Well, under a law passed by the federal government, it said that anything produced through child labor
that is transmitted through interstate commerce can be regulated and thus outlawed by the federal government. Well, interestingly enough, the Supreme Court said no and declared that law to be unconstitutional in the case Hammer v. Dagenhardt.
Why?
Well, in the law that Congress passed, they attempted to ban items that were purely intrastate. And they could never prove if something that was made by a kid actually did flow interstate. Because what were the jobs that the kids were doing? They weren't really making anything. They were usually sweeping up the factories. Or they were like, if it was a weaving machine, they would be the one that would climb into the weaver and, you know, would kind of make sure the thread was there. Or they would help out on mom and dad's farm. Or if you ever learn about the Lowell Mills, the Lowell girls. You know, if mom and dad were farmers and they had nothing but daughters, they would send the daughters off to go work a few years in the factory to make a little bit of income to help the family out.
Well, they basically said, the Supreme Court, that Congress's law was too vague. So they struck it down and said child labor okay. They also said the same with minimum wage.
Atkins v. Children's Hospital.
Case that was decided in 1923.
District of Columbia passed a law that granted minimum wage to nurses, female nurses, that worked in hospitals in and around Washington, D.C.
Well, long story short, the case gets up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court basically said, no,
minimum wage is an interference with contract rights. The government should not be setting minimum wages, because a wage should be negotiated between you and your employer. Because who actually knows the value of your labor? Not some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. No, you know what your value of your labor is as well as your boss. So you should be able to set what the wage is. So the Supreme Court said no to minimum wage laws.
And lastly, because I know our time is up, and then we'll start the Great Depression when we come back on Thursday.
What about unions?
We all know what unions are. Well, one of the tactics that shop owners would use were things known as yellow dog contracts. Yellow dog contracts. So for you to get a job, you would have to sign a contract. And in the contract, you basically promised you would not attempt to create or join a union. Because if you did, you would be in breach of contract. In other words, you're fired. Well, the Congress passed the law that said, no, people should be allowed to join a union if they want. Law gets up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, once again, strikes it down as being unconstitutional. There's nothing in the United States government, of the United States Congress. No, let's try it one more time, Lynette. The United States Constitution, maybe that's what I was trying to say, that gives Congress the right to regulate wages, working conditions, child labor, nothing there. All unconstitutional. So, progressive era was interesting times. We'll allow most expansion, but there's still some areas, no, not so much. But of course, attitudes would change again with another major significant historical event. And we'll pick up on Thursday. So, I'm pretty sure everyone sent me your topics. I think I replied to just about everybody.
If I missed you, I apologize. I had a crazy weekend. I do have some time tomorrow. I'm going to sit down and go through everything that I missed. Obviously, we're making our way through the Federalist chapter. We don't have much left. When we're done with this, we're going to have our first exam. So I don't think I'm going to be able to get through everything on Thursday. So that means we'll probably have our exam next week. All right, just kind of give you the heads up. And of course, like I mentioned on day one, your exams will be online at home, not during class time. So we'll just figure out a day that works best for everybody, and that's when the exam will be. All right?
Thank you.
Oh, thank you all. Actually, speaking of all, let's check in the people who came late.
Do you need my name or are
you done? No, yeah, I know who you are now.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And you're Michael, right? Yeah, I knew that. See, I'm good. I'm getting there. Bye. Enjoy the day. Jakira is here. Allison came in as well. I think I marked Allison. I did. All right. Come on in. I'm all done. What are you sorry about?
This is my theater class.
Well, yeah, I think the theater class is in here. Yeah. You can come in.